Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 30, The Decian Persecution. In the spring of 249, word reached Emperor Philip the Arab that one of his generals had revolted, and was now preparing to march from the Balkans to Italy. So the emperor dispatched an experienced statesman of senatorial rank to put down the usurper. But shortly before the statesman arrived, the legions had turned against the usurper and killed him. When Philip's general did arrive, the troops could see that this aristocratic man had the right qualifications to be emperor. He was strong, intelligent, and traditional. So, at the end of a sword, the legions forced him to become the new Augustus and lead them to Rome to overthrow Philip. The man they elevated to the purple was named Gaius Messius Quintus Decius. His reign is covered by Mike Duncan in episode 110 of The History of Rome. Decius' elevation was symptomatic of the crisis of the 3rd century, when troops raised up and deposed new emperors with alarming frequency. By September that year, Decius had defeated Philip and now reigned supreme as the ruler of Rome. The Senate voted him the name Traianus, hoping he would live up to the great Emperor Trajan, whom we discussed back in episode 9. Decius was from the conservative Roman elite. He believed wholeheartedly that the success of Rome depended directly on the disposition of Jupiter and the gods. If Rome was prospering, the gods were appeased. If Rome was not prospering, then that meant Jupiter and the gods had abandoned Rome, because the Romans were impious. So Decius decided that the best thing to do to get the empire out of the crisis and back to the Golden Age was to order that all his subjects do their patriotic duty and offer sacrifice to the gods. 40 years earlier, the Emperor Caracalla had made all free persons Roman citizens. Now it was time for these newly Romanized provincials to demonstrate their loyalty and help the empire with an act of piety. Towards the end of 249, the new emperor issued his edict. It stipulated that all denizens of the empire, except Jews, must make a sacrifice to the gods on behalf of the emperor and the state. Provincial governors were to oversee the process in conjunction with a board of magistrates, and make sure everyone sacrificed before the deadline. Once a person had sacrificed, they were issued a libellus, or ticket, verifying that they had not only performed the sacrifice, but also swearing that they had always sacrificed to the immortal gods. Today, we actually have 43 extant libelli, dated between June 14th to July 12th, 250, which survive from the sands of Egypt. I've posted a picture up on the blog site of some of these. While the main purpose of Decius' edict was pagan piety, the correlated goal of suppressing Christianity was also intended. Some scholars have attempted to exonerate Decius by emphasizing Roman piety as the reason for the edict, and claiming the persecution of Christians was an unintended consequence. But as we have seen, by the mid-3rd century, Christianity was too well known and public for Decius and his court not to have been aware of the effect his edict would have on the religion's adherents. The suppression of Christianity was not an unintended consequence, but a natural corollary to satisfying the gods. A universal sacrifice meant the forcible suppression of the Christian faith and the reconversion of its followers back to their old deities. When it came to the enforcement of the edict, recalcitrant Christians were typically punished in the following way. If they had either A, refused to sacrifice outright, or B, did not possess their ticket when the deadline for sacrifice had passed, then they were to be arrested. Their case was then referred to the local governor. It was up to the provincial governor to determine how long to keep them imprisoned, what tortures to use to make them conform, when the confessor should be tried, and finally, if deliberate execution was warranted. The goal in all this was not to kill all the Christians, but to use force to compel them to sacrifice. only if these measures proved too brutal, or the governor lost patience, was death actually the result. Because of this process, Christians of more prominent position, whether being bishops or being of high social status, or both, as was often becoming the case, were the most directly sought after victims of the persecution. And so it was that at the start of 250 AD, the first imperially ordered empire-wide persecution of the Christian Church came about in the Roman Empire. Across the Mediterranean, numerous Christians would be executed for their faith, but many more would give in sacrifice, denying the Lord in front of men. Just as Origen had feared, many in the church were not ready for persecution, not ready to face the reality of martyrdom. They had grown accustomed to the relative peace the church enjoyed in the early 3rd century. The result was a disaster for Christianity. Ultimately, the church did recover, but not before a great deal of internal conflict, schism, and pain. As we cover the persecution, keep in mind that all the usual caveats apply when dealing with stories of martyrs. There are many other acts of martyrs alleged to have died under Decius than those we will discuss, many of them based on historical martyrs whose veneration is attested to early on. But these texts are late and legendary. There are also many martyrs named in the later martyrologies, calendar listings of saints' feast days in local churches. But many of these are simply names on a list. Our coverage of the Decian persecution will be limited to the body of historically reliable records. We will begin our account of the persecution in Rome and proceed east across Asia Minor, down the Levant, swing around into Egypt, and finish in Africa. Fabianus, the man who had been miraculously designated as Bishop of Rome some 14 years earlier, was among the first to be martyred. We have almost no details concerning the bishop's martyrdom, other than that it occurred in Rome on January 20th, mere weeks after Decius's edict was published. His relics were then buried in the catacombs of Callistus, which was becoming the norm for Roman bishops. After Fabianus attained the crown of martyrdom, the Church of Rome was not able to consecrate a new bishop for over a year. Shortly after Fabianus's death, members of his clergy were also imprisoned. With the loss of their senior leaders, the Roman Christians were led by the remaining presbyters. The chair of this council of presbyters, or acting bishop, was their most capable writer and theologian, Novatian, a man with whom we will have much cause to deal with over the next few episodes. To the east, an authentic record of martyrdom survives from Polycarp's community, the Church of Smyrna in Asia. The bishop of Smyrna, Eutechimon, betrayed the legacy of Polycarp and willingly sacrificed, worshipping an idol and encouraging others to join him in apostatizing from Christianity. So the task of upholding the faith of the Smyrnians fell to the prominent and strong-willed presbyter, Pionius. He was arrested and imprisoned with four other confessors. Among these confessors was a former slave woman, who had been forced to change her name and flee from her fiercely anti-Christian mistress. Another was a young man named Asclepiades, who, after his arrest, was threatened with being forced into a gladiatorial combat with the son of a local official. The interrogation of Pionius and his companions reveals that the authorities were aware of the divisions within the Christian community, as they asked the confessors which church they belonged to, i.e., Catholic, Montanist, Marcionite. Prior to the proconsul's arrival, the local officials and elites, including the famous sophist Claudius Rufinus, tried aggressively to force Pionius and co. to comply with the emperor's edict. The local pagans and Jews, who had lost none of their antipathy towards the Christians since the days of Polycarp, hurled abuse upon abuse at the confessors. To all this, the confessors stood their ground. Pionius even made a great speech to the crowd and his fellow believers, exhorting the truth of Christianity over paganism and Judaism. Finally, the proconsul, Julius Proculus Quintilianus, arrived from Ephesus. After a heated exchange with Paionios at the tribunal, the governor read aloud his sentence that Paionios was to be burned alive. Together with a Marcionite presbyter named Metrodorus, Paionios was martyred in the local arena on March 12, 250 AD. Moving further east, although he wasn't ordained a bishop until after the Decian persecution, Gregory Thaumaturgus was already working diligently to convert the local pagans when the emperor's edict arrived in Cappadocia. A layman named Troadius gave a public testimony before the governor and his deputy, and was subsequently burned alive. The martyr's boldness before the authorities provided not only strength to the local Christians, but aided Gregory's conversion efforts, as the local pagans were able to witness the strength of the Christian faith. In the Levant, two major bishops were imprisoned, Alexander of Jerusalem and Babulus of Antioch. Alexander, the friend of Origen, who came from Cappadocia and had built a great library in the holy city, suffered imprisonment and torture before his body finally succumbed to these ailments. The same fate befell Babulus of Antioch, the man who may have been the bishop who had prevented Philip the Arab from joining his congregation during the Easter Vigil. Among the other prominent victims in the East was the great scholar himself, Origen of Alexandria. Imprisoned and then tortured in excruciating ways, Origen survived the persecution, but his wounds were too severe. And in 254, at the age of 69, Origen died in Tyre, Phoenicia, where his friends buried him. Shortly before his death, Origen received a letter on martyrdom from none other than Dionysius of Alexandria, at long last healing the rift between Origen and his home city. For the persecution in Egypt, we are of course supplied with Dionysius's eyewitness account. Great and terrible fear descended upon the Christian community when Decius's edict arrived in Alexandria and was received by the prefect of Egypt, Aurelius Appius Sabinus. While some were able to flee, many Alexandrian Christians, out of fear for their lives and livelihoods, willingly sacrificed. Some did so pale and trembling as the crowds mocked them. Others sacrificed with enthusiasm, renouncing Christianity completely, or claiming they had never been Christians. Others were imprisoned and tortured, and only later succumbed and sacrificed. Despite all this apostasy, though, there were many of those whom Dionysius calls pillars, who held firm against imprisonment and torture, shining as model witnesses and inspiring the rest of the community. Among these was an old man named Julian. He was plagued with gout and could barely walk. He was brought with two companions before the authorities. One gave in and sacrificed, but the other, Cronion, held firm alongside Julian. Both were tied to camels, dragged through the streets of Alexandria, beaten, and finally immolated in a public burning. A Roman soldier named Bessas, who accompanied the two martyrs through the city, rebuked the insulting pagan crowd. This action cost him his head. A Libyan man, whom Dionysius calls Bless, was burned alive after refusing Sabinus' demands. Two confessors in prison, Epimachus and Alexander, endured long series of tortures, but the authorities could not break them, and so they too were burned alive. With these two martyrs were a diverse trio of women: Ammonarium, a holy virgin, Dionysia, a Christian mother, and Mercuria, a remarkable old woman. None of the tortures inflicted upon them by Sabinus could make them recant. Enraged that he was being defeated by women, the prefect finally had them put to the sword. Next were three Egyptians, Heron, Ater, and Isidorus, along with a 15-year-old boy named Dioscorus. The three men were brutally scourged and then burned alive, but Sabinus showed a measure of mercy to Dioscorus on account of his age. When the boy held firm, the prefect dismissed him so he could think over his convictions. Dioscorus would survive the persecution and continue in his Christian faith. Another Egyptian named Nemesion was arrested with a band of robbers, but he was cleared by the centurion of these charges, which he had not committed. But then a pagan informant revealed Nemesion was a Christian. After Sabinus inflicted tortures on the robbers, he inflicted double the amount on Nemesion. Finally, the prefect had them all burned alive. Dionysius could not help but point out the similarity between Nemesion and Christ, as both were executed alongside thieves. In a somewhat humorous occasion of martyrdom, Dionysius describes how a band of Christian soldiers frightened Sabinus and his council. As it looked as though the Christian he was trying was about to apostatize, four Christian soldiers, Ammon, Zeno, Ptolemy, and Ingenes, along with an old man named Theophilus, rushed the judge's table, boldly proclaiming their faith, scaring Sabinus and his servants in the process, while also strengthening the resolve of the other Christians. Sabinus appears to have recovered his resolve, though, and he had them all tried and executed. Outside of Alexandria, Dionysius also reports on the persecution. After he refused to sacrifice, a Christian servant of a local magistrate named Escurion was personally murdered by his master by having a large staff shoved through his stomach. Many other Egyptian Christians fled to the countryside and desert, only to die of thirst, starvation, sickness, wild beasts, or attacks by bandits. Some were captured and sold into slavery, or held at ransom by Arab raiders. A particularly sad occurrence was the old Caramon, the bishop of Nilus, who fled with his wife to the Arabian mountains. Later, when the persecution had abated, fellow Christians searched desperately to find their bodies, but to no avail. Those who were driven to the countryside who did survive the elements returned home as honored confessors. As for Dionysius himself, he was fully expecting to be tried by the prefect, and so waited patiently in his home to be arrested. As soon as the persecution commenced, Sabinus sent a frumentarius, or military agent, to arrest the bishop. Surprisingly, though, the frumentarius could not find Dionysius. Evidently, it had not occurred to him that the bishop would remain waiting in his own home instead of instantly fleeing. After 4 days had passed, Dionysius says God instructed him to depart. As he set out from the city with his friends and attendants, the bishop was overtaken by soldiers and arrested. As they were being led back to meet the prefect, one of Dionysius' pupils, a young man named Timothy, discovered the bishop's home was empty. The boy fled and was accosted by another man who was on his way to attend some all-night wedding festivities. Upon learning what had happened from Timothy, the wedding guests quickly informed the other guest, who all then in mass got up and accosted the Roman soldiers guarding Dionysius in a nearby village. Terrified at what looked like a large gang of bandits, the small band of soldiers fled. Dionysius was then rescued and placed on a donkey and led out of the village to a place of safety. Proceeding west from Egypt, we finally arrive in Roman Africa, where Cyprian's letters provide us a detailed account of the persecution. When Decius's edict arrived in Carthage, the ire of the pagan populace against Christians was readily roused. Not wishing to be the cause of a massive anti-Christian riot, the bishop departed Carthage sometime between January and March of 250. From his hiding place, Cyprian continued to run the church through his famous correspondence of letters. The early months of the persecution in Africa did not immediately result in executions. Instead, from January to March, recalcitrant Christians were only arrested and imprisoned and/or exiled. It was not until April that the Roman authorities introduced torture as a means to force Christians to sacrifice. Those who preserved under imprisonment and torture, naturally became honored confessors of the Christian community. Large groups and even crowds of local Christians would flock to the prisons to visit them. One of the most important reasons many lapsed Christians visited the confessors was to receive absolution for their sin of apostasy. By virtue of their righteous suffering, confessors were believed to possess the charismatic authority required to declare a person's sins forgiven, regardless if they were an ordained presbyter or bishop. If the confessor died and became a martyr, he or she would intercede on the lapsed behalf in heaven. For all the martyrs and confessors the Decian persecution produced, it did not match the countless apostates and lapsed Christians. By lapsed, I mean people who fell from the Christian faith, but still desired to return to the church, as opposed to apostates who left Christianity forever. For the lapsed Christians, there were two general categories. First, the sacrificers, those who had offered the sacrifices or incense, whether willingly or after a period of torture. Second, the certified, those who, while not having sacrifice, did obtain by means of bribery or other a government libellus saying they had sacrificed. Lapsed Christians who wanted to return to the church and receive communion needed to be forgiven for denying their faith in Christ. So many sought the intercession of the confessors. In Carthage, many confessors obliged and issued letters declaring the lapsed person's sin forgiven. The lapsed person then presented this letter to his or her local presbyter as grounds for receiving Holy Communion. While Cyprian kept in touch with groups of Carthaginian confessors, some of whom were members of his clergy, he came into great conflict with those who issued letters of absolution. Cyprian was adamant that first and foremost, the lapse should remain in repentance until the end of the persecution. Then the church could come together and decide what pastoral policy towards the lapsed would be. From Cyprian's point of view, by issuing letters of absolution in their own name, the confessors were inherently undermining Cyprian's apostolic authority as bishop, and by extension, threatening the unity of the church. On top of that, many of Cyprian's own clergy were accepting these letters as authoritative, either because they agreed with the idea or were intimidated by the crowds of lapsed demanding readmittance. Soon, the letters of the confessors were being traded and sold like the government libelli. This situation was absolutely unacceptable to the bishop. The lapsed should remain penitent and humble, not demanding readmittance as if they were entitled to it. Cyprian made only a small concession in this regard. He granted the confessor's letters authority only in cases where a lapsed Christian was on their deathbed. Cyprian's letters give vivid testimony to the ecclesiastical chaos in Africa over the problem of the lapsed. He wrote to confessors, clergy, and lapsed who both agreed and disagreed with his position, alternatively condemning and chastising each side. In support of his position, Cyprian found an ally in the Church of Rome. Over the course of August and September 250, Novatian and the Roman clergy corresponded with Cyprian and discussed ecclesiastical policy towards the lapsed. Both the Roman clergy and even the Roman confessors were in full agreement that reconciliation of the lapsed must wait until the persecution was over, accepting only deathbed penitence. Novatian and Cyprian both had moralist and rigorous tendencies. With the aid of the Roman Church and his local supporters, Cyprian worked tirelessly to gain support for his position in the African Church. But the result of both Cyprian's and Novatian's rigorism would eventually be Cyprian's greatest fear, schism, the breaking of the unity of God's church. Thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Please don't forget to leave a review on iTunes, post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, And don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.